and Entertainment, the podcast dedicated to exploring the universe of public domain media. My name is Christopher.
And I'm Lydia.
Oh, I was going to introduce you officially in a little bit.
Oh, you waited. Oh, you paused.
I did. I paused. Well, anyway, as you can tell, the task that I've set out for this podcast is too much for one man alone, so I have enlisted some help, and as you've already heard, I am joined by Lydia. Welcome, Lydia.
I'm only enlisted. I thought by now I would be at least an officer.
Our recent addition, Barry, had some stuff he couldn't get out of, so it's just going to be the two of us tonight.
Oh. Well, you know, two's company.
That's right. And Barry's just a nice guy.
Barry's just a crowd. No, we'll miss Barry, but we'll be all right.
Yes, we will. I was kind of looking forward to getting some of his input on this one. But this month, we're going to be discussing the first of several adaptations of the late Richard Matheson's novel, I Am Legend. This is from 1964, The Last Man on Earth, starring Vincent Price.
Woo-hoo, I love Vincent. Well,
yep. Yes, Vincent Price is pretty awesome. Although, I think maybe a little miscast in this one.
Oh, now you're reading ahead.
Yeah, this was, as I said, was based on a 1954 Richard Matheson book called I Am Legend. And the screenplay was actually, for this movie, was actually partially written by Richard Matheson. But he wasn't really crazy about how it was turning out. And in the end, took his name off of it, or actually I should say he chose to be credited as a Logan Swanson rather than actually use his name for it, because he still wanted the royalties for it, even though he wasn't crazy about the film itself.
Smart man.
Yeah. The film was done in Rome, Italy, to cut down on some production costs, apparently.
And you can actually notice that in the opening credit, or in the opening scenes, I should say. The buildings are very obviously not American buildings.
This movie actually has some interesting, pre-production drama involved with it. The novel was originally bought by a producer named Anthony Hines for Hammer Productions, the UK horror studio. And I'm really sorry they didn't actually film this, because I think that would have been really interesting.
I was going to say that. I wonder what would have been different if they had.
Yeah. Matheson apparently wrote a script for that one, but the British censors wouldn't even allow its production.
Interesting. I don't recall any nudity or swearing in it.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know what was in there, but British censors wouldn't allow it at the time. Hammer Studios had to give it up. The script was sold to a Robert Lippert. And then that Lippert told Matheson that Fritz Lang was going to direct a film. But eventually the director that did indeed film it, Sidney Salkow, S-A-L-K-O-W, I don't know any other way to pronounce that.
Salkow?
Was finally Salko?
I would say Salko.
I like Salko better than Salkow, I guess. And he was chosen, and then to save a little bit of more money, they, as I said before, shot it in Italy. And then a lot of the cast was indeed Italian, and I think you can even tell a little overdubbing was a post-production dubbing was done in to fill in some of the English language. And you can tell it a little bit. Every now and again, you notice the lips don't quite match the voices coming out of the mouths there.
Mm-hmm. I actually didn't really realize that it wasn't. I thought it was just like the sound was a little bit off. Like occasionally you'll get back in this era, you know, where mm-hmm. they kind of, I actually think we even saw that on the last movie we reviewed on Beware the Blob. I felt like there were some parts of the sound that were off a little bit. And I felt like,
yeah, it's possible.
I thought that was the same thing. But now that I know, of course, that it was dubbed over, then that makes a little bit more sense.
I think I only noticed it more. I've noticed it in this film, and I think probably because Vincent Price obviously wasn't. It was all Vincent Price. Mm-hmm. You can't mistake Vincent Price.
Right.
But then whoever he was acting against in the scene would talk, and that's when I noticed why that doesn't. It just didn't seem to sync correctly. Mm-hmm. And it is just because the differences between the two, I think, is what kind of made it a little noticeable
pointed
for
it
me.
Out.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Pointed it out. Well, the film itself. Which, you know, I know Matheson wasn't terribly happy with it, And the film does have a few flaws, and I think some of the script changes and everything kind of detract from even some of the subjects that are brought up in the film. I think they kind of contradict themselves a little bit. I still think it's a decent film and probably actually the closest adaptation to the source material.
I think that's probably very likely.
Yeah, and it, believe me, it does wander quite a bit from the book, but it is the closest, certainly much closer than I Am or Omega Man, and closer than the most recent I Am Legend.
Which is, you know, an adaptation to appeal to the modern audience, of course, but...
Exactly. This film opens with some shots that you were referring to, the shots of some cities that seem to be an empty world, except for some bodies lying around, which I thought were very effective shots. I mean, they definitely set the tone really quickly with those.
Well, it's funny. I've seen this before. I think I may have even seen it before I Am Legend came out. It may have been during the time period when it was coming out, and I realized that it was, you know, from an actual book that had actually been made into movies before. What was interesting to me is that in every shot there are like two or three bodies laying around, as opposed mm-hmm. to now, obviously, we're so oversaturated with special effects and makeup and all of that. Usually, if you see a bunch of dead people laying around, it's like 100 dead people.
The entire town square.
Exactly.
Right, yeah.
So now you have, you know, two or three people, and none of them are missing any limbs. You know, you don't see...
No blood.
You don't see any of their faces. Actually, Vincent Price's face is the first one you see in the film, mm-hmm. you know, which I'm sure was somewhat due to censoring at the time.
Right.
They probably didn't want to have it too gory, so you don't want to have, you know, ripped off faces or anything like that, like we do now. So,
exactly.
but it was interesting. I started contrasting it with modern films where we're so oversaturated with the special effects that something this simple, which is probably actually more accurate. When you take into account the storyline that comes on further in the film, you know, to only have a couple or three of them in any given area. I'm rambling, but my point being I've lost my point.
I think you made your point, Lydia, many sentences ago.
I did, and I think I just kept talking. I do that sometimes.
I think because of, like you said, the censorship issues that were probably there, and probably financial too. You can only hire so many extras or find so many mannequins
or
clothes and whatever.
Right.
I think it actually makes it really effective, because what happens, you see, it starts out with very distant shots. You see the big, large overviews. Mm-hmm. And then you sort of kind of snap in closer and closer with each shot. And so you don't see any bodies at first. And, you know, the first couple of scenes, you don't see any. And then it's the third scene, maybe. And there's like a body. Mm-hmm. And then the next scene, maybe there's two bodies. And then you kind of, it builds it up a little bit, I think. And it actually becomes really effective. Mm-hmm. Next thing we see is an alarm waking up our hero of the film, played by Vincent Price. His character is Robert Morgan. And we see him go through what appears to be a daily routine. He kind of gets up and wanders his house, which has been fortified, it looks like, against break-in. He's got some odd this and that's hanging around. He's got mirrors on the outside doors. He's got ropes of garlic hanging around.
Boarded up windows.
Exactly. Yeah, you kind of see him wandering. He's deciding whether his garlic wreath needs to be replaced or not. He's checking gas in his generator. Just makes kind of notes about the bodies that happen to be littering his front yard. And then, of course, makes a pot of coffee.
But all of this in voiceover, where he's expressing just kind of the thoughts as they flow through him.
Yeah, what do you think of his voiceover? Goes on through most of the film. And the sort of ghostly narration is kind of... in almost any film is either, well, it's more often than not panned, but I think it's kind of necessary. It's certainly for the time this film was made, don't you?
I definitely agree. I think especially the audience in the 60s, if you had a film, I know recently there have been, you know, dabblings in films with no dialogue or with almost no dialogue. But I feel like during this time period, especially if you had come in and had an hour-long film with maybe 10 minutes of dialogue in the whole thing, or maybe 20 minutes of dialogue, you would have lost most of the audience. So especially during this time period, I feel like it's very appropriate. But more to that point, I feel like it probably follows a lot of the flow of the book, or a lot of the flow of the story, because, you know, it is the last man on earth. The only conversation he'll have is going to be in his own brain. It's in his own mind. So to be following him through, and it is, you know, explaining a little bit, especially taking into account this is one of the films that predates most zombie or, you know, post-apocalyptic films that we're accustomed to now. You know, I mean, I know this was reported to be an influence for Night of the Living Dead, which we think of as being one of the very first zombie films, you know, and this actually predated that and inspired it. I think that it makes more sense to, oh, I've lost it again. Damn it. I think it makes sense to have that narration in there, because you're in this time period appealing to an audience that hasn't had exposure to all of that type of storyline. So they're not going to know that a random man waking up to, you know, an alarm clock and wandering around and seeing dead bodies laying in his front yard. They're not necessarily going to have that expectation that we have, oh, this is a zombie film, or, oh, this is a post-apocalyptic film. They're going to have to be told what's going on.
Right.
That was a really long monologue. Sorry. And you just listen.
Well, you make some excellent points, so I'm not going to interrupt you. But I think it does, you know, with the little bit of the inner monologue that you hear and with what you see, you're going, I mean, it's definitely, again, helps really set the stage and does give you a really good idea that this is a man who apparently for the past 3 years has been by himself and has developed this routine. And it's all very commonplace for him. It's no big deal to look outside and, oh, there's a body, you know, this is just, it's what he does. He goes to this lathe and whips up another batch of steaks.
Right.
you know, it's no big deal. He doesn't play it as being anything special. It's just something he does. And it really comes across that way in the film.
It really does. And, you know, he references it near the end of the film. He says, you know, I'm not afraid of them anymore. You know,
right.
He's used to it. This is his daily life for the last 3 years.
Exactly.
So
he finishes a little. Sorry,
I was just going to say, I really do enjoy it that this film was released in 1966. It starts the beginning of it.
64,
it was
actually.
Made in 64 and then I believe released in 66. Is that?
It was released in the UK.
Read that. Good. I'm glad.
Yeah.
Because when I first watched it, I thought, oh, it was made in 64 and they released it in 64 and then it's set in 1965, which is a really common, you know, kind of ploy that they use now, you know, in the year 28 Days Later came out, and I think it was set in the following year. So, I mean, I don't know whether this was done before The Last Man on Earth, but we definitely have picked up this, you know, setting apocalyptic films in the year after the current year. So I enjoyed that they had chosen to do that.
Yeah, they really give you the feeling that this literally could be next week. Mm-hmm. All the events could start anytime.
Exactly.
They don't set it off in the, you know, far distant future where you don't have to worry about it because it's 10. Oh, that's, you know,
exactly.
I won't be alive
a long time
then.
Ago in a galaxy far away. I mean, this is happening here next year.
Exactly. They put it right in your
backyard. Yeah.
In your backyard. Thank you. Exactly. Well, after Mr. Morgan goes about his daily routines around the house, he collects the bodies from his front yard and loads them in the back of his station wagon and goes for a drive to a rather large pit and unceremoniously dumps the bodies into this thing.
The pit, he calls it. And it seems to be, tell me if I'm wrong, it looks like it's still burning 3 years later.
Yeah, well, he even feeds it a little bit. There's gas cans on the edge of the pit, and so he drops a couple bodies in, and he pours a little bit of gas and throws down another, throws down the container. And so it's you get the feeling that this thing has been. We find out later through a flashback later on what this pit is and when it started. So yes, apparently this pit has been burning for the past 3 years for the sole purpose of destroying bodies, and that is, I mean, the pit is probably the most ghastly element in this film, honestly.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
And it's made even more so further on down the film when we get into the flashbacks.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. I was just going to, I mean, this is, you're coming out 20 years after World War II, where they saw this thing in reality. You know, you would see this kind of pit in other places. And yeah, we are removed from it now. We as Americans don't have exposure to this type of thing. But at that time, you have to imagine it would have been really horrifying to see this in the U.S.
Exactly. And then he does some shopping. Collects some more garlic and some mirrors. And then he goes hunting, which they do in that brilliant little, you know,
montage scene
of him finding people hiding under blankets and in dark corners and apparently staking them through the hearts.
I have to admit, this was one of my biggest complaints about the film. He's staking, you know, these creatures, these people, whatever they are, he's staking them, but he's got a mallet and he just kind of is half-hearted about the mallet use.
Yeah, okay, thank you. Yeah, I was going to say the same thing. It's about the most half-hearted staking I think I've ever seen in the film.
He's just kind of like, tap, tap. And I thought, yeah, that ain't going through a breastbone. Come on. Which I suppose in the 60s, most people didn't know. They didn't have CSI back then. But you know what I did on my vacation last week, but you know, bones. But that was, I think, my biggest complaint was they, for obvious reasons, don't show him actually staking it. We aren't getting, you know, Dracula dead and loving it here with the blood spraying all over. It's very muted, but also extremely half-hearted. I was a little disappointed.
Yeah.
I was hoping to see a little bit of, you know, I mean, it's Vincent Price. I wanted some R in it, you know, some, the drama. But he just kind of is, the tapping.
Right. Well, you definitely, I think it would have been interesting because you don't want to see him looking tormented about doing it because he's been doing this for years. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this is something that he does.
Right.
So he could still have a very nonchalant look about his face as he does it. But I would have liked to have seen him put a little bit more body
muscle.
Effort.
Yeah, yes. Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Well, now it's got to be back home before dark. Apparently, these whatever he's fortifying the home against does not like the daylight. They hide in the dark places and only come out at night. And the house is attacked by a shambling horde, to which he just listens to and falls asleep. So, as you said, you know, he's not afraid of them anymore. Mm-hmm. It's just background noise to him.
Now, is this the part he puts on music? I think at this part, and
he does have some music playing.
And you know, these creatures are. He mentions that they can't stand the sight of their own reflection. It repulses them, and so he's got mirrors up. And but they're still. They've got bits of wood. They all have bits of wood.
Yeah,
I mean, it's kind of. I just thought it was interesting. They all came. I'm a little brainwashed with the whole zombie genre, which I know this isn't exactly that, but it is much more similar, I think, to the zombie genre than to others. And mm-hmm. they all come up with, like, sticks of wood. So it was interesting that they had the presence of mind to get pieces of wood, but not to get pieces of anything else.
Right. And they also, again, talk about, you know, half-hearted. they all apparently don't have much strength about them, mm-hmm. so they sort of just kind of low arms swinging against the door. They're not, you know, they don't look like they really have much control of their bodies. That's, again, a very big shift from the book. In the actual book, the zombies are very active. They, as active as you, me, or anyone else. You know, they can jump, they can climb, they can talk. Yeah, so this was very different. Although we do get the one talking, his late friend Ben, who shambling outside.
Morgan, come out, come out.
But you're right. I think that I am not even going to finish that sentence. My brain is failing me.
Okay.
Just skip that part. Just take that part out. Morgan, do you hear me?
Well, he wakes up the next day and he goes to start his usual routine, but today it just feels a little different apparently, and he stops. He starts the lathe and gets ready to go to work on another batch of steaks and just clips it off and heads off to visit a mausoleum in a graveyard. And then, of course, dozes off. And I don't think, do we actually find out precisely what grave he was, or mausoleum he was visiting?
No, but he does, he sits down and he says, Verge, you know, I think he says it's been 3 years, Verge, which we find out in the beginning of the movie that it's been from 1965 to 1968. And he just says, I miss you so much, Verge. You know,
okay.
And so we don't know yet who this Verge person is.
See, I'd have just assumed it was his wife, but then, of course, he falls asleep, and we get the flashback later on where we find out.
That's way down the line.
Yeah,
but he wakes up, and it's nighttime.
Yeah, it's already night, and they're going to be all over the place. So he has to fight his way to the car, and then, of course, races home and has to fight his way into his home.
He drives home in some day for night shots.
Yeah, I believe so. And once he gets home, he passes the night away watching some home movies. Some of the, again, talk about the sort of typical 60s home movies that have almost impossible shots. You know,
right.
He actually got out of the bleachers and got down onto the floor of the circus so he could turn
he
and shoot.
He turned around completely, exactly.
At least they weren't any of the ones where they actually have him in it. And you're wondering, well, who took
Who's holding the camera? Actually, yeah, I'll be honest, I kept waiting for him to come into one of the shots, at least, you know, to have that classic family shot of the, you know, three people standing together waving at the camera.
Right, camera, tripod.
I kept kind of waiting for that.
How long should
we
stand here?
And somebody runs away, you know, and obviously turns it off. I was kind of waiting for that one. In fact, I was confused at first because it does show the woman that features in this home video, talking to and I think hugging this blonde man who we later find out is Morgan's best friend.
Mm-hmm.
But at the time I thought, well, who is this weird family that he's, I thought, oh, he's watching other people's home videos. and then later realized, of course, that's not the case. It is actually his own home videos.
Yeah. And that's something I actually kind of really appreciate about this film is there are some things that happen that, you know, it doesn't all seem to – it doesn't take place in a linear fashion. Mm-hmm. And you don't meet the people in a linear fashion.
I admit, when the flashback happened, I think it starts at this point, I was surprised because I had – I think the standard kind of structure during this time period was to start at the beginning and work through to the end. So it is interesting that you start kind of – close to the end of the story, and then in the middle you have this big chunk of flashback, which I think lasts like 10 or 20 minutes, doesn't it?
Yeah, a good portion of the film.
A very good portion of the film.
Yeah. And I don't think it's ever expressly pointed out, but the one, I guess, lead zombie or vampire, whatever you want to call him, is his best friend, Ben.
Later on, he says, that man outside that you hear calling me.
Oh, that's right.
It
is
in the very end. Mm-hmm.
You're right, but it's not mentioned. You actually kind of had to piece it together when you actually see him in his normal form. You're like, well, wait a minute. Is that
suit on? And you think there was a guy trying to get in with the suit that was calling him. Yeah.
Exactly. They do keep the clothes the same. And I think that's really the only connection that would really make it stand out for
him. It is, and it's a little tough to see. Now, I'm curious to know, there is a color version out. Did you watch the color or the black and white version?
Black and white.
Okay.
I did not know there was a color version around.
I watched the black and white version again because I'd seen it before. And then out of curiosity last night, pulled up the color version. And it is much easier to tell the difference because in the black and white version, you can tell that these are creatures. You can tell that they're monsters of some type because of the way that they act. But you don't see it very well in the makeup. I think the one part where it's very poignant is when he's flashing back and you see, of course, the big climax to the end of the flashback scene. And at that point, the creature involved there is obviously made up, but without the color, you can't really tell. In the color version, which is obviously post-colored, you can really tell the difference between the flesh tone of the living people, and then they have this pasty, almost black and white look.
Interesting.
Yeah, it really is interesting. Even though you can tell that it's obviously been colored in post, it adds. I don't want to say it adds a lot to the film, but in a way, it's easier to distinguish the one from the other and to kind of, you know, draw that distinction that it's harder to draw when you're watching the film in black and white.
Very interesting. I'll have to look that one up and give it a watch. I've never seen a color version, so I'd be really interested in seeing
it. It's available on YouTube, and they have it available in high definition. And I actually, you know, especially for somebody that's not a big black and white fan, and it's, I think the...
Boy, are you on the wrong podcast.
I know, right? No, but if you... You know, if maybe, well, I hate to say it, if you're easily confused, if you have a memory problem, it actually, I don't think that it detracts from this particular film to watch it with a color version, which is strange. I usually would not recommend a color version that's been done in post, but in this case, I think it actually adds a little bit to the makeup, it adds a little bit to the effects, because it just makes things a little bit clearer, a little bit more crisp.
Right, fantastic.
All that to say. So I think that's the thing, is you can tell, you know, in this flashback scene, his friend Ben is obviously alive, but you can see, I honestly think that you can tell a little bit better because there are the coordinating colors on the suit and the hair. You can tell it's the same person, just in a much better condition, basically.
Okay. Let's get a little bit into his flashback, because, like I said, it does take up a good portion of the film and does fill in the backstory to find out how we get to this, to where we are at this point in the film. As he goes in, right before he sort of passes, he falls asleep after watching these videos, but I guess he doesn't fall asleep, but the flashback begins. But it starts with the Vincent Price doing, you know, watching these home videos, and something funny happens or something, and he goes into that sort of maniacal laughter,
yes,
which then cracks into, you know, uncontrollable sobbing. And it's one of those kind of brilliant little, it's a Vincent Price
moment. It really is. And it's funny, is it's one of those that I think everybody's had, where you are holding it together, you know, on a very thin line, and then something happens and you start laughing, and then it just, that crumbles, it takes away all the veneer, and you start crying. So I love Vincent Price in this type of scene, because mm-hmm. you feel exactly what he's feeling.
Exactly. Well, we discover that Robert Morgan is a scientist, and we get a story that there's a plague that appears to be just floating around the earth, carried by the wind.
In Europe, to start with. It's always the Europeans.
Exactly.
No, I'm just kidding.
I know. It's always in Europe. Damn it. No one can seem to find a way to combat this thing. Nothing, no current medicines or anything can destroy this virus or bacteria that's floating around.
I love this scene, too, because he goes from, you've seen this birthday party with this little girl in his home video, and then mm-hmm. he goes to the actual day, and it's obviously her birthday party, and you know, you just know, as you do in movies, that it's his daughter. And, you know, they have this newspaper clipping about this widespread disease, and his wife says, oh, do you think it's really true? And he says, well, I can't believe it. There's not enough, you know, evidence to indicate to me that this is really going on. And she says, oh, well, let's go cut the cake. And I thought,
yeah, exactly.
And I thought, I love it. People in the 60s are very, very cheerful about widespread disease. They're just like, oh, we'll deal with it when it comes up. Oh, let's
cut the cake. I don't think it's just a 60s thing. I think, you know, if something's happening across the ocean, you know, you hear about all this plague or a drought or whatever. You go, when you're reading it, you go, oh, that is just so sad. That's too shame. But on with my life.
Exactly.
You know,
yeah,
it doesn't affect you. Don't let it affect you until it actually affects you.
As long as the cable doesn't go out, we don't really think about it.
Exactly.
Until Netflix raises their rates. Hey, I love Netflix. Don't get me wrong. But yeah, you're right. Until it affects you, it really doesn't.
Yeah. We do get to meet his wife, Verge, and his daughter, Kathy.
Now, I have to ask, what does Verge stand for?
I always thought Verge was short for Virgil, but that's a male.
Right here, Virginia.
Virginia. There you go.
No, he calls her Verge. And I was like, Verge, that's a weird name for a girl. Maybe it's Virgin. No, Virginia. Okay, there you go. And there's a quote where she's saying, oh, anyway, never mind. We'll come back to that. I'll do it when we get to the moment.
All righty. And then, and as we were talking at length before, we do meet his friend Ben, who they all refer to him as Uncle Ben. I guess they are indeed very close friends, but I don't think related. At first, I thought maybe he might have been a brother-in-law. I don't think it's not expressly said one way or another.
Yeah, he does say my best friend, but it doesn't specify that he's not related to Virginia.
Yeah, but Kathy does call him Uncle Ben, but that is something that certainly would easily be done if he was just a man. A close friend of her father that was always in her life. Of course he's going to be Uncle.
Yeah, or right. It could be product placement. I'm just saying.
Rice magnet.
Exactly.
Right. Well, it's not before long before the plague starts hitting a little close to home. His wife and daughter get very sick. And Robert Morgan is, at the lab, at the local university or medical facility or something, working hard on a cure.
And it's a name that I've heard. I can't think of what it was, but when you're watching it, they actually say where he works, and I thought, oh, I've heard of that place, but now it escapes me. I have no idea.
Oh, I completely missed it and didn't write anything down about it.
I didn't, but I remember watching it and thinking, oh, I've heard of that place before, or it could just be something similar to something I've heard.
Right.
The streets are swarming with truckloads of bodies that they're throwing into that god-awful pit. And the dedicated Dr. Mercer goes on with his plodding, unimaginative approach.
You have a better idea?
Maybe. At least it involves imagination.
Ben, it's as simple as this. An unknown germ is being blown around the world. It's highly contagious and it's reached plague proportions.
And you don't believe some of the dead have come back?
Now let's get to work.
And why are they burning the bodies? Why don't they bury them?
Because it's the best known way to control the contagion, to keep the germ from spreading.
That's what we've always believed, at any rate.
You'd prefer us to believe in vampires?
If they exist, yes. There are stories being told, Bob.
By people who are out of their minds with fear.
Maybe. But there are too many to be just coincidental. Stories about people who have died and have come back.
They're stories, Ben, stories.
And why are the infected people always so tired in the daytime? Why can't they stand the sunlight? Why are they only seen at night?
Come here. Look.
I know it's
look. Now, is this bacilli or isn't it?
It doesn't alter.
And this bacilli is found in the blood of every infected person, or isn't it?
To show me germs is not to refute these stories, Bob. Point is, if there are vampires, they exist in spite of these germs.
Come on, let's get to work.
I think where he says something about coming back to life and drinking blood, and I think that's where
I don't think blood comes into it. There's very little talk about them drinking blood.
I'm sure he says the V word at this point.
Yeah, I'm not saying that the word vampire or vampiric doesn't come up, but the actual
drinking
act
blood.
Of drinking blood or discussion of that is very mute in this film.
It is.
And I have a feeling that has to be a matter of censorship.
Censorship, probably.
Civilization appears to be pretty much unraveling around them. No cure has been found. The poor daughter dies.
Well, and before that happens, he does see them. The military starts coming and taking dead bodies away, and you see his neighbor, screaming, "No, don't take my husband away. Let him be buried with me."
Yeah, is you hear it on the radio, or there's a TV broadcast saying that if you have to call us, you have to let us know.
We'll come.
And yeah, they come and haul the bodies away.
And
so Vincent Price tells his wife, he's like, "You do not call anyone. Do not call a doctor.
Don't let anybody
in the house." Mm-hmm. And he goes off to work. Pretty much the entire lab staff is afraid to come
in
anymore.
And Ben shoos him away from his door, says, leave me alone, go away, I don't want to see you.
Yep, it's all over, just get out of here, I'm going to save myself and keep myself locked in the house. I was curious, I don't know, was it a matter, were they concerned about the wife catching it? The whole time the daughter's lying in bed with doing her, mommy, where are you? I can't see you, and flailing her arms, and it's like, at any point does like the mom or dad not want to like maybe hold her hand
I totally agree. I thought, why not say, I'm here, honey. Even if you're crying, at least say, I'm here, sweetie. You know, even if you're not allowed to touch her, just say, it's okay. Just lie still. But no, they talk to each other and ignore the daughter and let her say, mommy, where are you? And which I also thought maybe she's deaf too, because she clearly doesn't hear them talking right next to her bed. But again, it is one of those moments where I'm sure at that time, you know, when this film was coming out, this poor child flailing. But no, they do mention that, and then the Virginia goes into the other room and she's all, oh no, I'm okay, I'm not tired. She goes in the other room and almost collapses, you know?
Right.
And then he goes off to work, he goes to pick up Ben. Ben says no, and Robert goes on to the lab.
Right. Very good.
Thank you.
Well, Morgan comes home to find a military truck parked outside his house, packing up and driving off.
Every weekend.
And he storms inside. Verge is just sort of almost catatonic in the living room chair. He storms into the bedroom. Kathy's gone. And, of course, Verge did break that and call a doctor, but Kathy died, and they hauled the body away. So Morgan goes tearing after this truck, and he ends up at the pit where they're just unloading bodies like cordwood and dumping them down this giant pit.
Yeah, and they do. You know, at some point he says, did this just come from Market Street or wherever he was on? And the guy says, I don't know. Right. You know, so he runs off to another one, and this moment, I think, is a good indication of the horror of his situation at that point, because he says, you know, I want my daughter. Give me my daughter. And he said, and the army man says, army man, the soldier says, there are a lot of daughters in there. And he says, they're my daughters in there too, you know? And at that point, it's like Vincent Price realizes, you know, everybody's daughters, they're all, everybody's dying.
Exactly. Well, it's not long after this that the Verge herself falls victim to the plague very quickly, much quickly than the daughter did. You hear a scream, Robert, I can't see. And he runs into the next room and she is dead.
At least it was, you know, a short period of suffering.
Yes, no, exactly.
Very short.
Well, Morgan will not allow her body to be just dumped in this horrible pit. So he sneaks off with her to an empty field.
I do want to say, really, you said it at first, and then we kind of brushed by it. But yeah, this whole scene that, you know, really is flashback, I think, to the horrors of World War II and all that. And again, and I think it shows the shot of the bodies down in the pit. Obviously, it's not real bodies, but it's just kind of this melted heap. But again, you know, this realization that there are hundreds and probably thousands of people just down in this pit, just burning. It's I just totally interrupted you to just point out how depressing that is. Sorry.
Well, the pit is just, it's a fantastic little, I don't know if you want to call it a set piece or just a, I don't know the right term for it, but you really do get the idea. And like I said, I think it is just the most horrid thing in this film. Because yes, you see all these bodies piled. You even see a very small bundled package being tossed down this hill as he's, you know, trying to get his daughter back, and they're just flames shooting out and smoke, and most people have gas masks on, and you get the feeling that this has got to be the most disgusting thing to see, to smell, to be anywhere near.
Well, and I thought, honestly, you know, they mentioned that this disease is airborne, and here they are burning these bodies and all of this, these piles of smoke going up in the air. And I seriously was watching this thinking, it seems like a bad idea to me to throw these things on fire where the heat flushes it all up into the air. Honestly, I almost wondered if they wouldn't touch on that being one of the causes of it spreading so widely. I really thought that. I thought, you know, if
well, there was actually an interesting, if you read into the conversation, and I don't know if you're really supposed to or not, if you read into the conversation he has with Ben at the lab, when Ben brings up the idea of people possibly coming back from the dead, and Vincent Price, oh, no, that's ridiculous. It's just stories. And Ben says, well, then why are they burning all the bodies?
Right.
And then, of course, Vincent says, well, that's the best way to make sure that the disease, you know, blah, blah, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And so you do wonder if you read into it, there is a little bit of a conspiracy.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
that well, the definitely. Government,
there
the people in charge know.
Well, was it,
right.
But beyond that, maybe this is my conspiracy theory in itself, but I felt like, wouldn't it just be like, oh, gosh, God, I'm going to try really hard not to get political on this. Wouldn't it be just like the government to think they've got the best solution and to throw all these bodies on fire and then all of the disease to go everywhere because it's rising up in the smoke and getting spread across the entire nation? Not nothing political about that at all, NSA. But I think, you know, that's a I know that's not a message in the film, but it definitely made me think about that. Think about the hastiness of trying to, you know, quench a fire that, you know, like with the ones that you throw water on and it just makes them worse.
Exactly. Well, since I didn't know exactly where you interrupted me, I'll start.
Saying so he refuses to let his wife be buried.
Well, Morgan won't allow Verge's body to be dumped into this pit. So he sneaks off to an empty field and buries her. And I guess what must be later that night or the next day, shortly thereafter, he hears a whispery voice.
It must be at night.
At night.
Sorry, I was just thinking back to the requirements of these creatures.
Yes. The wants to just keeps calling inside into the house to let her in. And he opens the door and Verge is standing outside, of course, covered in dirt and looking rather... not too healthy.
Grotesque. I think is probably also one of the creepier parts in the movie, because even though you and I, with the experience that we have of, you know, the whole zombie lore, I know, again, this is not a zombie film, but, you know, we kind of know, oh, wait a minute, we know what's coming here, you know. But it is, I mean, he opens it up and she goes from being this really remarkably beautiful woman. You know, they have her made up and her hair is really good. Even when she's sick and dying, she looks remarkably good. And then all of a sudden here she is and she's grotesque. And it seems like they did a really good job on the left side of her face. Her eye looks kind of gimpy, droopy.
Yeah.
And her mouth is kind of misshapen and her hair is a mess. Very Bride of Frankenstein. You're right. She's got the dirt all over. I love that, though, because you really, it looks like she's been buried. And it's not something, I think it's not really common for horror creatures to look, or maybe it's just difficult to make them look very dirty during the black and white period. But she really does. She looks like she has crawled out of a pit.
I think, you know, you mentioned that this film, or I'm sorry, that the book, and I'm sure a bit this film was an inspiration for Night of the Living Dead.
Yeah.
I think this scene alone, I think, could be pegged as an inspiration for the entire Night of the Living Dead film.
Yeah.
Well, then the flashback ends. We are back to the present. We don't see exactly what happens to Verge, but I guess considering his visit to the mausoleum, we can guess that he has to kill his own wife again. And I guess he then puts her body in this mausoleum.
I feel like they missed.
There's something missing. There's a lot missing there.
I feel like there's a missed opportunity. Not necessarily that you have to see him stake his own wife, because that probably is outside of the, you know, regulations for the censorship at this time. But
I
almost wanted her to rattle the lid on the coffin. You know, you want her to be nailed in there just to make it more horrific, you know?
Yeah, you wanted something that says, well, I can't take the chance of her coming back again, so I'll put her in here. You know, I'll put her in the concrete.
But I can't bear to murder my own wife.
Yes, exactly.
You know? I sort of wanted that. It's horrible, but I just felt like that would just really, pardon the pun, be the final nail on the coffin to make this really a horrible story.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there. Well, never mind. I'll mention that later. Well, we are back to the present day, and it's yet another day.
Oh, man,
day.
That was a long flashback.
It was a long flashback. It is. We are
it
back
is
to the present.
It is a very long flashback.
Morgan needs a new car. His old station wagon got beat up by last night's attack.
They were so mad that he came back after dark. Sounds like my yes. parents. That's it. No more car for you.
So he goes shopping, and we go back to some little bit of the inner monologue again. You know, trying to pick out a car. Oh, convertible would be nice, but you know, like there was a time when I
used to shop
for a car, but now I'm shopping for a hearse.
I love that line. That's so mm-hmm. very Harold and Maude.
What's that?
I said very Harold and Maude. If you don't know it, look it up. High school.
So he finds a new station wagon, but it's not too long after that he actually spots a dog. I guess after he parks this new station wagon in the garage, he spots a dog on his street. An actual live dog, which apparently is very surprising to him. Apparently this plague affects animals as well as it does humans.
He says, I think when he's first talking to Verge, he says, I miss birds. I didn't realize how much I would, but I miss birds.
Yeah, okay. So apparently it affects just about everything. Or you could, you could make the assumption or guess that, you know, the animals, the creatures that, you know, man become have a need a food source. But he goes looking for this dog, but the dog disappears. It runs off.
And he chases it.
Does chase after it, and he discovers some bodies that appear to have been staked by someone else other than him, staked with what looked like metal harpoons.
Mm-hmm. I actually thought they were torn off from wrought iron fencing.
It looked very much like that,
yes. It really did. And it also brought to mind that the age-old story, the last man on earth sits alone in the room, suddenly there's a knock at the door. I thought, yes. Oh, creepy.
The dog ends up returning that, but it is a short-lived relationship. The dog is injured, and he tries to nurse it back to health. But he does take, a blood sample from it and discovers that the dog is suffering from the plague. He has been afflicted.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. I want to ask you this. Does he mm-hmm. kill the dog preemptorily, or does he wait until the dog dies and then stake it?
Well, it's kind of interesting because when you see him burying the dog out in in an orchard or whatever, it's actually almost comical because he's got like a burlap sack package with a stake
with a wooden
sticking,
stake
out, of
sticking
it.
Out of it. Exactly. So I'm curious. I really, this is not something answered by the film. This is purely up to speculation, but I want to know your take on it. Does he preemptorily kill the dog, or does he wait until it dies and then stake it to prevent it from waking up and trying to eat him?
I think that's why the stake is sticking out of the bag. I think he probably bagged it and staked it pretty much after the scene fades when he discovers that the dog is afflicted. I'm assuming he just put it in a bag and stayed.
I think so too, which I think one of the most tragic parts of this movie, because obviously he's talking to this dog. This dog is frightened. It's nighttime. There are creatures outside trying to get in. The dog knows that they're out there. And he even says, you know, they're out there, don't you? But it's going to be okay. Everything's going to be all right. Which are the same.
Oh, yeah, the man
he
is
said,
hungry for the man is hungry for companionship.
Those
and he
are
thinks
the same
finally
words
yeah.
he said to Verge. And I thought, that's I'm really great foreshadowing right there. You know, as soon as he starts saying, it's going to be okay, you know that it's not.
It's not.
Really, that actually is quite good storytelling. But, and then, yes, you're right. He's so desperate for somebody that's not trying to kill him, you know, and he's so happy that there's even this dog, even this little, you know, poodle, I guess it is.
Some mangy poodle.
Yeah, he's just so happy to have another creature to have this companionship with. And so when he looks and he sees it and just, you can tell he just falls apart, you know, starts I think he starts laughing again, kind of maniacally. And at that point I thought, I'm sure he stakes it preemptorily, which is all the more tragic when as the story progresses.
Oh, absolutely.
So he's burying this dog.
Yes. He's burying a dog in like this orchard or a park. And he happens to look up and there's a woman out in the daylight. Just standing there.
Just walking along, looking tired.
Yeah, he chases after her, and of course, she runs, but he grabs her.
I would run if a guy started yelling at me. hey, you! Leave me alone, crazy man!
But he convinces her, like, I'm not one of them. I couldn't be out in the daylight. I'm like you. And brings her back to the house. Their relationship is a little bit of an uneasy one. We find out her name is Ruth. It's very short. I mean, the moment. From the time that they meet and they have a little coffee to the time you discover that there is something not quite right about her is mere minutes.
It is. And it's interesting to me. I don't think there's anything to implicate her, but all of a sudden he goes to the door and he takes down the garlic and he starts chasing her around like a guy with a lizard chases a woman. I'm telling you, like, of all the mean things to do, you bring this woman back to your house, you start chasing her around, trying to shove something in her face, really? But but you do find out that the garlic makes her sick.
Yes, and what she tries to write off is just always having a sensitive stomach.
Yeah, some of us do.
Yep, and it's true.
I'm just kidding.
But he, I guess, is willing to give her the benefit of the doubt. She goes in the other room, and you see her react to her reflection in a bedroom mirror. And she grabs what looks like appears to be a syringe. She's trying to give herself an injection when he bursts in. And it turns out that she was one of these vampires, and that there is a group that has found a way to sort of deal with the plague.
One of them.
I was. And without that injection, I'll be one again.
What do you mean?
You found a solution?
That's right. Exactly as you said it could be. I take that for it.
What is it?
Defibrinated blood plus vaccine. The blood feeds the germ. The vaccine keeps it isolated. And prevents it from multiplying. We've had it for some time now.
We?
There are quite a number of us.
And I thought you were alone. I was going to cure you. Does that amuse you?
No.
Now, I want the truth. I want all of it. Why are you here?
To find out if you know any more than we do. You know far less. We're alive. Infected, yes, but alive. We're going to reorganize society. Do away with all those wretched creatures who are neither alive nor dead. Start everything all over again.
And you want me to join?
You can't join us. You're a monster to them. Why do you think I ran when I saw you? Even though I was assigned to spy on you. Because I was so terrified of what I'd heard about you. You're a legend in the city, moving by day instead of night. Leaving as evidence of your existence bloodless corpses. Many of the people you destroyed were still alive. Many of them were loved ones of the people in my group.
I didn't know.
Is there any way you can get out of here?
What do you mean?
They're coming after you tonight. That's why I was sent here. To prevent you from resisting them. And supposed to keep you here. Until they come.
To kill me?
Yes.
Your new society sounds charming.
The beginning of any society is never charming or gentle.
And you pretended to be shocked at my violence.
That they are all going to be coming for him.
And she's there to keep him, so she pulls a gun on him.
Yes, oh yeah, an actual gun. There you go. Haven't seen anything quite that, you know, advanced.
In a while.
Film. But I don't remember how it happened. She gets knocked unconscious. Did she pass out?
She collapses, yeah, because she doesn't get the chance to give herself the injection, and so she collapses,
right.
And he takes the gun away from her.
Exactly.
And then he eyes her speculatively. Right. Oh, no, sorry. And that was just my imagination. It's Vincent Price. Come on. He's amazing. Yeah.
he spies everyone speculatively. Well, we next see she's on the couch, and he is giving her a transfusion with his own blood.
There are so many comments that I could make about that statement. Sorry, yeah, you were saying.
Hoping that his antibodies will cure her of the plague, which apparently it does. What's that?
I got to get past my dirty mind. Give me just a second. He's giving her a transfusion, hoping his antibodies will cure her. All right, I'm good.
Are we
no.
done? Are you sure?
All right, sorry. So she's on. He's giving her a transfusion.
Yes.
Of blood.
But it's as far as he can tell, it has worked. She is cured. Her blood is clean. But it's all for naught. She leaves the house
He goes. She's actually good.
Yeah, I know. That's what I mean. It has indeed worked. She has been cured, but it's all for naught because the new society, the military, whatever
it's
you want to call it.
Second. She says, we have to get out of here.
Right. He goes into the kitchen to check the blood sample once again, and she disappears outside when he goes out to look for her.
He goes to look for her, and she's yelling. She's been grabbed by his best friend.
That's right. Yeah. Well, he goes out to look for her, and she's been attacked by some of the zombies, vampires. Vampires. I'm not sure what to talk. Vampires.
They call them vampires.
They call them vampires. We'll go with vampires. And a military-like force moves in and begins to kind of clear out these walking undeads.
This, again, one of the more interesting moments in this movie, I think. There's the part where it shows, you know, they're coming in and they're kind of getting these other vampires. Sorry.
Mm-hmm.
And
easy to do.
I know, it really is. And there's a moment where it shows all of the vampires that are infected and still affected by this virus, and then it shows the other side. It shows the ones that are, you know, quote, dealing with it, that are all dressed in black, and they all have these kind of harpoons or spears all ready.
And guns. And machine guns,
and all at the same time, they all thrust their spears into the vampires, and you kind of have this moment where you think these people are killing other people that are exactly like them, except for having a vaccine.
Right. Well,
I don't know how much of that was intended in the movie, but I feel like that's a wow
again,
moment.
I feel like I'm sort of filling in blanks, and I think that's sort of a problem with this film, is that it leaves you to have to fill in a lot of blanks.
There are kind of a lot of blanks. I feel like much that could have been filled in with it.
Yeah, and I'm filling in the blank that once you actually die, you're dead. There's no coming back from
that. Okay. Now that's not.
And so that's why you have the shambling vampires. But if you get this vaccine, I guess you can't call it a vaccine, but if you get this medication before that mm-hmm. happens, then you are carrying it. You do have it, but it doesn't kill
now,
you.
Now, I thought at some point Ruth said, I was one of them.
Yeah, I know. And that's one. It's just one of the many little minor flaws in the script mm-hmm. of this film.
There are several loopholes.
Plot holes, yeah.
Plot holes is a better word for it. Plot holes.
But after this military force, after they kill off the undead, they go after Morgan. They spot him, and he runs off. He does get shot, wounded pretty badly. He eventually finds his way to a church where they all corner him. And he is eventually...
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, and then you know, despite he can't hide from him, they finally corner him. And in a bit of a standoff, finally one of them harpoons him and gets him. And as he's dying, he curses them all as freaks and mutations and screams that he is the last man on Earth right before he passes on.
See, now, and everybody ends the synopsis there, but I disagree. It's
all right.
Wrong. That's not the end of the synopsis. Synopsis. Wow. The brain connections. That's not the end of the brain. There, because Ruth comes in, and she mm-hmm. and she goes up to him and she cradles him. You know, she says, "No, stop, everybody, stop." And they say, "Wait," you know. And she goes and she cradles him, and he says, "They were afraid of me. They were afraid of me."
Freaks, all of you, freaks. mutation. You're freaks. I'm a man. The last man.
Robert.
They were afraid of me. They were afraid of me. They were afraid of me.
I didn't know.
You know, and it's just this moment where he up to this time has been the only human on Earth.
Mm-hmm.
And you, all of a sudden, I love it that I see this juxtaposition of he is the classic monster hunt. He is the classic version of Frankenstein's monster in this, where they're chasing him and they wound him and he staggers in, and at last they corner him and they kill him. And it's incredible to me because you have this person who is, he's the only human person left in the world, the only humane person left in the world. And these creatures are hunting him, but you turn it around and you look at it as every human in the world is this monster that they're terrified of. I can't express it well, but I love that turnaround where you're looking at him thinking, oh, all these creatures around him are monsters. And at the end of the movie, it's him that's the monster. I feel like it's really powerful. I feel like the end of this movie is one of the more powerful endings I've seen in this era.
Oh, absolutely. And this is actually something, although they sort of split it between a scene earlier on with when he's talking with Ruth and then this final scene, the idea, which is a lot more prevalent in the actual novel, which is something I would recommend you that you give it a read, get a hold of it. I think you'd really like it because in the end, the main character, not named Morgan, but named Neville, he realizes that he has become this new society. What he doesn't realize, because he holds himself up all night long, what he doesn't realize is that, you know, society moves on. Mm-hmm. Yes, everyone gets this plague. They get the medicine to help them control the effects of this disease, and society rebuilds itself. But then he goes out during the day when they all have to sleep, and so he's become like the boogeyman to this new society, and that's what he realizes. And they're one of the final I think it might be actually the final line in the book. He says, "I am a new superstition entering the unassailable fortress of forever. I am legend." Mm-hmm. So he is truly just as these vampires were to him. Mm-hmm. Now he is to them.
Exactly.
Yeah, and that's actually very indicative of a Matheson story.
Mm-hmm.
He always has this.
Oh, iRobot, they did it too. Yeah,
exactly.
I need to read more. I've only read a little bit, but I want to read more. But that's exactly it. I'm sorry. I don't know why it reminded me of this. There's the phrase in Japan, which is "ore niwa ore ga aru," which, wow, makes me sound super smart. But what it means is the opposite of the opposite. So you have your own view is not the same as the opposite of what the opposite of your view is. It's this complete turnaround, and it's the same. That's the same kind of concept. It's not just, you know, you're the good guy, like I'm the bad guy and you're the good guy. It's that you see me as somebody that I'm not actually. Sorry, right. That was kind of, again, a ramble, but it. I feel like there's a layer to this that you miss unless you've seen it.
Yeah.
Or read it.
Exactly. No, but it is a fun, it is a good film. It does have, as we said, some plot holes.
I would say it's a good story.
The
film, it's a respectable film. It's Vincent Price, whom I love. And I think you mentioned it, and I said you were reading ahead, but, you know, we did point out that, well, I don't know that you pointed out, but the author actually says that he felt that he loves Vincent Price. He thinks Vincent Price is fantastic, but that he was miscast in this film.
Oh, yes, yes, Matheson on Vincent
and
Price.
And I actually, as much as I love Vincent Price, I actually agree. Vincent Price he's very, I think you put it very well, he's very good at the dramatic moments.
Yes.
But you struggle a little bit because so much of this movie is meant to be pertaining to the mundane. So I think so much of it, he is supposed to look like and feel like a really normal man. And because it's Vincent Price, it's hard to see him that way.
Exactly. And this moment, too, where Vincent Price, I think, is really good at, he kind of exemplifies horror, certainly through the 60s, and fear, but not the action star.
Exactly.
And so you have moments where you need someone that is very just ordinary. I'm just a guy and this happened to me. Mm-hmm. And then there's moments where this character has to be, you know, the action man. He has to do the jumping and the fighting. And Vincent Price, and the staking. And Vincent Price really doesn't fill either of those roles.
Yeah, I do agree.
But then there's those few moments,
the dramatic moments
when Vincent Price cracks, goes from laughter to, yeah, exactly. It's, you know, you can't imagine anyone else doing it.
But it feels like those very small moments in the movie, they are very small moments. And for the,
yes,
you know, and I think part of what makes the end of this movie work is that it does come back around to not just, you're all freaks, but it comes back around to they're afraid of me. Yeah, what, you know, that dramatic kind of shift where he kind of can't comprehend. I'm just a normal person. Why would they be afraid of me? You know, which perhaps may have been better. The displayed isn't the word I want, but may have been, you know, better communicated through another actor. But most of the movie is about just this normal man who's just trying to survive.
Yeah, and I think, again, talk about. And I think even Matheson mentions in that same quote about he thought the direction wasn't as strong as it needed to be. Mm. And I definitely think that might be the case, too. And
kind of
I
a troll, too, kind of issue.
Yeah. And I think I don't know who finished the script. I know he did a lot of it, and I'm sure it went through a rewrite or two after he walked away from it. But the moments where he really, like the Morgan realizes what's been happening. Ruth tells him that, you know, you're killing people in their sleep. There's this new society. And at no point does he go, oh, I should go talk to them then. You know,
well, he says, I can save them. But
right.
I think at one point they mention, well, it's too late. But I feel like they missed it when she says, you killed them. Some of those you killed were still alive. There isn't that moment where he says, oh, my gosh, I've been killing live people.
I've been
killing people who can think and reason and are like me, even if they can't come out in the daylight. I think that's another one of those plot holes. They just missed. They missed a step that they could have really developed and made, you know, pungent. Pungent. really meaningful.
Yep. And I think, and again, in the end, I think is unsteady, the fact that he's hunted down and, no one ever says, I mean, he doesn't call out, I can save you. He doesn't, or whatever.
We can work through this, but they just kind of ignore him.
Yeah, and then actually, and you can even think the story moves on because now the woman is cured.
Mm-hmm.
She's not one of them anymore either.
I was curious about that too. It is one thing that they just skip because in theory now, and I thought of that as she was walking down the aisle at the end, you know, and she says, you know, stop crying. There's nothing to be afraid of. The monster is gone, I think is what she says. But I thought of that. I thought, now she's a daywalker. Not a ginger, right. Just a person that can go out in the light. but I did think of that. I thought, well, you know, so he was the legend of it, but now she can go out in the light. So what then is the implication?
Yeah, where is her place in this new society?
Now, can she save everybody because she has his antibodies in her? To take that step and heal her, I feel like they left a loose end.
Oh, I think there's actually a really great story that can be made that takes place after this.
With her, I totally agree.
With her and this new society. Because now you have this new society and you know there's someone at the top of the society. Mm-hmm. Do they want to be cured? Now, do they have power because they discovered how to control this or what? Whatever.
That's just taking into, you know, there's a cure for cancer out there somewhere.
Exactly.
Again, conspiracy theorist. Not a hardcore one, but enough that I definitely. Yeah, I mean, you know, medicine develops where there is profit. And you're right. I mean, it's a great question. Is that the case in this story?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. I think that this should be a the end question mark kind of film.
Mm-hmm. I definitely.
The story, or, you know, and the story continues kind of thing.
Wow, I feel like I should go and write this now.
Yeah, I know.
As Ruth left the church.
Yeah.
The screams of the dying man filled her ears. Okay, so anyway. Though his heart had already stopped. Okay, move quick before I keep going on this one.
All right. Well, I'll tell you what, I don't know if there's really anything else we said. I think we even kind of gave some of our final thoughts of the film, honestly, even in the middle of the conversation. So I don't think there's anything really left to say.
I know. One of the biggest questions I had was about the dog. I just thought, you know, what kind of man was he? Was he a man that was, and I think this is kind of maybe one of the implications, is he a man who's so afraid that he would kill a dog to prevent it from, you know, dying and turning into a vampire dog? Even though we don't see any indication of vampire dogs in this, is he that man? And right. I think it's interesting. I think almost that moment is the moment that kind of makes you sympathize and say, yeah, he is kind of a monster.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just kidding. But no, I think, weirdly one of the biggest questions, you know, how a person will treat an animal or a child is, okay. You know.
My recommendations would be to read the novel, and I would recommend to see this, to watch this film, but don't expect to take it terribly seriously. Like I said, it's a good story behind it, not executed as well as it could have been.
I agree. I think it's one of those that I struggle with a little bit looking at these creatures as vampires, even though I think partially because of the era that I grew up in. I grew up in the era of the zombie, and these creatures are so similar to the modern day zombie, you struggle a little bit with it. But it definitely, especially if you like classic films, especially if you like Vincent Price, House on Haunted Hill will always be my favorite. But I just enjoy watching him as an actor. And I think this is, regardless of whether he was miscast or not, this is an exceptional story.
Yep. You know, and I just had the thought, too, what I might recommend is to actually watch this and The Omega Man along with actually reading the book as well.
I really want to watch The Omega Man because I have read a little bit about it, and now I'm very curious exactly how bad it is.
Oh, I wouldn't say it's bad. It's a film I actually really like.
Oh.
It does, but it drifts. It pulls some from the book that this does not, and then vice versa. Mm-hmm. So I take the book and then this film and that together all in one, and kind of you can see the little bits and pieces and stuff. And of course, then each of them are a bit of our products of their time, mm-hmm. whereas this is very 60s. The Omega Man is very 70s, mm-hmm. Which also makes it very interesting.
Right. I keep hearing in my head.
Okay.
The $6 million man.
Yeah.
Every time I hear Omega Man, that's what I think of.
Unfortunately, the most recent film with Will Smith, I Am Legend, I think it misses on too many. It's as weak of a adaptation or a blah. As much as the last one and the I can't talk now.
Adaptation.
Yeah. As much as The Last Man on Earth, I think is not executed as well as it could have been. And had some pretty major plot holes. I think the Will Smith I Am Legend is worse.
Oh, interesting. Because I have seen I Am Legend. It's been a little while. I should have watched that again recently just so that I could have that to reference while we're talking about it.
It's one of these things where it seems painfully obvious to anyone who's watching the film at some moments that these beasts, don't think you can call them vampire. I guess you could still have to call them vampires.
Yeah,
I don't know what
they
call them. They still don't come out today. But the moments when he kidnaps or captures the one female.
Oh,
And then the alpha male actually comes outside and risks getting burned by the sun, mm-hmm. and everything. And it's painfully obvious that, okay, you know, there's something there that this creature has some feelings, he has some connection to this female, mm-hmm. and our hero Will Smith sits there, it doesn't dawn on him, and it doesn't dawn on him at all through the entire film. Mm-hmm. And then there's many moments like that mm-hmm. in the movie where it's obvious to me that there's more going on, and Will Smith never notices it, and it doesn't even seem like the person writing the script notices mm-hmm. it. And I really fault it as being worse than The Last Man on Earth.
Yeah.
So.
Well, that's interesting. I think it's a valid point to make that this is, you know, an one adaptation of a book that is a very well-written book, or at least a very interesting story, a very involving story, you know, and the fact that there are others, I think is testimony to that. The other adaptations, yep. I mean.
Exactly. All right. So anyway, that's my recommendations. I guess that's kind of your recommendation too, then. Would you say, I mean, you still would recommend someone watching the film?
Oh, honestly, I enjoyed I Am Legend, the Will Smith version, and I definitely okay. enjoy The Last Man on Earth. Obviously, I'd seen it before, and I was happy to watch it again. I was happy to watch it a third time in color. So,
yeah, I'm going to go find the color one.
It's on
now.
YouTube, yeah. And it is in HD, so I definitely recommend it. You know, if only to see the... you know, the differences between the two versions.
Absolutely.
But, yeah, definitely. I think this is probably, of everything we've seen so far, the movie that I would most highly recommend.
All right, fantastic. Well, I guess that is going to do it for us this month. Thank you, Lydia, for another fun discussion.
Thank you, Christopher.
I want to also send a thank you to the regular listeners of the podcast,
yes.
and we welcome any new listeners. We hope you continue to download any future installments of Orphan Entertainment, which, of course, you can easily do by subscribing via iTunes. And while you're there, you can rate us or leave a comment. If you'd like to get in touch with us with any suggestions, comments, or general feedback, you can join us on our Facebook page at facebook.com/groups/orphanedentertainment. You can leave us a short voicemail using the SpeakPipe app on our podcast homepage, and you can drop us an email at orphanedent@jonja.net. It's JONJA.net. And all the links and info will be in the show notes as always. So again, thank you very much. Lydia, again, thank you very much.
Thank you, Christopher. I enjoyed it.
Absolutely. I did too. And we will be back next month with another fun film from the archives of public domain. Not archives. I don't know. What would you call it?
The ethereal...
we'll go back to the universe of public domain entertainment.
The Valhalla of public domain.
All right, before we're going to start rambling again. All right, goodbye everyone. See you next time.